Good afternoon. This is Torn in Two, your news and information program. I want to first let you know that my friend and brother, Greg T. Roberts, is not with us today. He's doing a little recovery. We wore him out pretty good on Election Day, so he's home recovering, and he's allowed me to steer the ship today. So, you know, you get a nice package on holidays, and you're wrapping it, and the last thing you do is you put a bow on it. That's what we're going to do today. We're going to put a bow on the election. And there's nobody better to talk about elections. Nobody helps me think clear, challenges me with some ideas to think about than my friend. We call him the professor. Will you welcome to the microphone today, Professor David Takitaki?
Well, thank you so much, Pastor Burns. It's great to be with you.
Yeah.
We obviously miss Greg, but hopefully he gets some good rest and recuperation. And I also want to say happy Veterans Day to everybody out there who says.
Oh, and I'm remiss in saying happy Veterans Day to those of you that have served, as well as posthumously to my father and my three uncles that all served in World War II. Dave, they all served at the same time, World War II.
Wow, yeah. Now, my grandfather was part of the Army Corps of Engineers in Okinawa. And,
cool.
Yeah, we get a few cool stories from him from time to time.
Yeah. Not related to what we're talking about today, but I happened to see a comedian was doing a little story last night, and he was talking about his family being Chinese-American and being involved from the Civil War, you know, up until current wars. I just thought that was kind of neat. You know, we think about, you know, Chinese Americans fighting in the Civil War, especially. So mm-hmm. I thought that was pretty cool.
Immigrant populations have always made up a big chunk of our armed forces. And so, it's definitely cool. It's a story that goes back that long in this relatively young country. So, yeah.
I guess we can call it our country too, can't we?
Absolutely.
Yeah, so good. That's a discussion for another time. But hey, mm-hmm. Big day Tuesday. Elections, we had all kind of things happen. So we're going to talk about a little bit today. Why don't we start off, let's talk about here in Muskegon County. Maybe had a few surprises. Professor, what are your thoughts? You just kind of looking to be able to sit back now and look at what transpired here in our county?
I think if we do take that step back a little bit, Muskegon County's comparative balance has shifted somewhat.
Yes.
It used to be a very, very strongly blue county, right? We used to be able to look at overall numbers, sometimes 75-80% would turn out for the Democrats. It is still a blue county, but it is not a blue county to the extent that it was just, you know, maybe 10 or 15 years ago. We're seeing margin of victory numbers that are closer to 60-40, which is still a 20-point spread, right?
Yes.
But what it means is that we're seeing some of the county commission seats, some of the balance of power in our local county commission shift quite a bit.
Yes.
We're also seeing, differences not only in the way that our immediate state representative lines are drawn, mm-hmm. but we've also seen the way our local Senate district is now, it seems to be pretty solidly red, with it being counterbalanced with additional areas north into Oceana and Owego County, which are pretty solidly Republican. So we saw a strong candidate in Terry Sable, former three-time state representative, not get over the line in his Senate race. Well, John mm-hmm. Bumstead will be representing us in the Michigan Senate for another year.
Mm-hmm.
But that also contrasts with the larger statewide result where we see a Democratic Senate majority for the first time in nearly 40 years. So the local scene is very, very interesting. Local former legislative aide to Terry Sable, Will Snyder, won his race and was expected to. But even that race in the newly drawn district is less strongly balanced towards the Democrats than previously, which I think at the end kind of speaks to the power of that redistricting process that we saw. The idea was to make seats more competitive, and it appears to have done so.
Yeah, I've said a couple of times I was a little skeptical of that redistricting commission, but though the goal was to make the elections competitive, you can't trust mm-hmm. either party to have control of redistricting, and I think this election we saw that good competitive races.
If you look at the statewide results in terms of the big statewide races, what you've seen is you've seen the legislative districts now move into comparative or closer to parity with the statewide results. Previously, because of the districts being drawn the way they were, you could have, previously it was the Democratic Party, could win a majority of the statewide votes and still end up with only 40 of the 110 legislative seats.
Right.
And that's again, was described as one of the strongest partisan gerrymanders in the country. And that's not really good for democracy, regardless of which party does it, right?
No.
So the Independent Citizens Redistricting Commission shifted those boundaries, and now we're seeing the fruits of that shift, and that the amount of seats won by the Democratic Party is generally kind of in line with the amount of votes they receive percentage-wise across the state, which is much closer to what we'd want to see if the democracy itself is going to be representative.
Yes. You know, here at Muskegon County, we went from the 9 commissioners down to 7. Mm-hmm. And again, but I think it's fair to say we're a little surprised that the commission split. But had it still been 9, I haven't looked laid out the numbers, but it seemed like going to 7 with the redistricting played to the Democrats' favor a little more maybe than they even anticipated.
Mm-hmm. So if you're thinking about the way districts are designed, the two ways in which you try to shift things either towards fairness or potentially unfairness are what they call packing, where you take all of the votes for your opponent and you pack them into one area, and you're going to lose that area, but maybe you win the rest of them.
Yes.
The other one, of course, is cracking, where you take that same packet of votes, and instead of packing them all into one, you split them up into, two or three or four so that they can't get a majority anywhere. When you reduce the number of seats, right, so we went from 9 to 7, it is going to require you to not only redraw those boundaries, but it's going to make some of that process more difficult, right? You can't pack into 7 the same way you can pack into 9.
Right.
You can't crack amongst 7 the same way you can crack amongst 9.
Okay.
And so I think what we're seeing now with a modest Democratic majority is probably more in line with the overall county disposition, right?
Yes.
I think that process, much like the larger statewide process, brought things closer to being in line with where the population is. So,
And I think that's preference. 9 people is a lot of people to try to get get something done with. And I think the 7 is maybe more in line with the size of a population of our county.
They say frequently that there's a reason there are no statues to committees, right? It's because they're always hard. They're always, it's always where the sausage gets made. Another metaphor. And fewer people can mean that there is more opportunity for, good, productive debate. Can also mean that you only need 1 or 2 people to really be obstructive and you can't get anything done. I have hopes for the Muskegon County Commission moving forward. I think, we've got some experienced voices on there, and there's a couple of more incendiary figures as well, but I'm hopeful.
Yes. Looking at the statewide elect, the governor, governor, lieutenant governor, the attorney general, and the secretary of state. The governor had more distance between her candidate than the secretary of state and attorney general, which, again, I call that a little bit of surprise. But what do you attribute that? I mean, they weren't major differences, and all those elections were probably closer than I kind of anticipated. But what do you make of the narrowing? Do you think fewer people are voting down the ticket?
Yeah, so I have not seen the full numbers, but there's always going to be a curious number for what they call undervotes. And that's somebody who comes out and they vote for 1 or 2 things on the ballot and they leave the rest blank. So there's a lot of undervotes. And I might wager that on the Democratic side, you might have seen a significant number of undervotes for your down ticket races. You probably see, and I'll have to look at the numbers when they're completely released, people who maybe walked in and voted for 1 or more of the proposals, the governor, and left. Because obviously the governor's race is kind of the most marquee race of all of them.
Sure.
And while obviously the Secretary of State's race and the Attorney General's race are very, very important, they don't get the same kind of statewide publicity as the governor's race does. There aren't, the debates don't get covered as much. And with the proposals potentially being strong draws, I think we'll probably end up seeing some of those under vote ballots are the reason why those numbers are different. There's also the possibility that in terms of the Secretary of State's role in administering elections, there may have been individuals who were either strongly in favor of Jocelyn Benson or strongly against Christina Carano because of her perspective regarding electoral fraud. Basically, she's a supporter of the big lie theory that the 2020 election was corrupt. And Attorney General Nissel has been relatively strong in her defense of democracy and is, you know, a controversial figure in some circles because she is, you know, a very kind of publicly unapologetic member of the LGBTQIA community. And so I can imagine that even generically, there would be people whom might be more comfortable with Whitmer, but maybe not as comfortable voting down ticket.
You know, about two weeks before the election, his name just escaped me, who just won Terry Sable's old seat.
John Bumstead.
Yes. We were talking, who won the House seat.
The House seat, that's Will Snyder.
Will Snyder, yeah. He was talking, and he was kind of trying to keep from putting a grin on his face, and he said they were starting to project that they might take the House. Never mentioned the Senate. You know, certainly looks like the Democrats overperformed. Again, to say maybe it's more balanced, but I don't think we ever saw any projections that they would take the Senate again.
And we'll talk about the national level separately. And I saw that comment from Houston about Michigan doing our thing, and that's exactly right. All of the projected standard midterm demographics, all of the normal math, said, and as you heard many of the people on the Republican side proclaim, that it should have been a pretty decisive election for Republicans across the country. In previous situations like this, where you had a national figure like the president with a approval rating under 50%, you know, 43, 44, somewhere in there, where you had, you know, 7, 8% inflation, you normally would have expected to see the Republicans pick up 60 seats maybe in Congress and things along those lines. You would have expected and was at one point in time projected that a governor like Governor Whitmer, who has a lot of strong adherents, but also a lot of people who were very upset with her, you know,
because
her actions during the pandemic and, you know, the way that she has positioned the state, you would expect to have strong resistance. And in an election otherwise kind of slanted towards the Republicans, you would have expected to see losses. Michigan completely flipped the script. Absolutely blew out the Republican Party up and down the ticket. There were some strong, you know, obviously House of Representatives seats for the Republicans at both the state and national level, and, you know, some of the state Senate seats. But this in Michigan was a blue tsunami. No one saw this coming. To the extent that not only did we have all of the statewide, you know, higher office elects, so governor, lieutenant governor was with her, attorney general and secretary of state, but all three statewide proposals passing. And interestingly, all of the seats for university boards of trustees or boards of regents all went to the Democrats. Maybe the only statewide race won by a Republican was incumbent Supreme Court Justice Brian Zahra, who came in and won along with incumbent Supreme Court Justice Richard Bernstein.
And attorney generally, people tend to vote for incumbent judges, and that was pretty close in itself.
Was very close. We almost saw, you know, Michigan unfortunately missed the opportunity to elect our first Black woman to the Supreme Court. But I do get the feeling she'll be a candidate again in the future. She's an excellent, excellent judge.
She can go have that baby and get back at it.
Exactly.
I saw commercials when she'd do a little thing with her stomach. I was like, oh, that's cute.
And it's again, symbolic of the extra hurdles that frequently, you know, female candidates have to jump through when trying to navigate their careers in public service.
I've been following Michigan politics for, middle school, high school. And, you know, again, I can remember, you know, Republican Governor Milliken and Democratic, you know, Secretary of State, Attorney General. Mm-hmm. You know, that's just how Michigan was. You know, we'd split. Yep. You know, people in Michigan would split their ticket. You know, and mm-hmm. just so again to have what those said, all the executive branch as well as the legislators is something. We'll see how it looks governing, mm-hmm. but you know, we certainly the rest of the country is looking at Michigan. Michael Anthony Smith says down in Texas, giving a thumbs up to his home state.
It's going to be interesting too if we can talk a little bit more about the Michigan side. The mm-hmm. Not only do we have our first female Senate Majority Leader, we now have our first African American Speaker of the House here in Michigan. Yes. We're seeing some firsts coming from this new Democratic majority. Mm-hmm. But a lot of the things that have been fixtures in Michigan politics for a while mm-hmm. may now have the opportunity to shift. Feasibly, this new trifecta majority, we could see something like the right to work legislation that was put in place by Governor Snyder in the lame duck. That could go. And we could find ourselves, you know, reinforcing rights for collective bargaining and supporting unions and workers in this state for the first time in a little more than 10 years. Yeah. So there's a lot of big stuff that can shift in this state that I don't know if people really wrap their mind around as we've been considering the election, and hopefully for the better.
Yeah. Yeah. We'll look forward to seeing how that transpires. I saw somebody comment, now it's time to dismantle all that Snyder did. And so certainly you'll think that'll be on items will be on the governor's agenda going forward here. Mm-hmm. I was just thinking, Michigan didn't have the first female governor, did we?
I don't believe so.
I know we had one like early on, like 40s or 50s, maybe. Am I mistaken?
Yeah. That is not a benchmark that I recall in terms of our state. May well be. I'll have to look that up.
In my mind, somehow I'm thinking of a female governor, but a name is, when you were talking, a name escapes me, or I might be having it confused with something else. Mm-hmm. And so Tuesday night, we knew a little bit about what happened nationally. Then Wednesday night, we knew a little bit. Mm-hmm. Thursday night, we knew a little bit more. And today, we know more, we know less than we did Tuesday night, depending on how you look at it. So let's talk about Tuesday night when we went to bed. What did we see? We saw we didn't see the red wave. Mm-hmm. And we saw some Democrats clinging on to some seats.
Yeah. So as we went to bed on Tuesday night, the first initial numbers coming specifically out of Florida mm-hmm. actually suggested, okay, maybe the red wave is going to be real. We saw Governor Ron DeSantis, who's been controversial in a number of his positions, mm-hmm. Cruise to a pretty substantial victory without being challenged. Now, the term candidate quality is going to be something that's going to get discussed a lot about this election. And there were some people who were complaining on the Democratic side that former Republican Charlie Crist was perhaps not the person who was going to most successfully motivate a Democratic majority in Florida. Sure. However, just as we've kind of looked at different dynamics, Florida was always a swing state. It was considered to be a purple state. It could go either way.
Yes.
As several elections suggest that it may no longer be a purple state. So that may be something that's now kind of baked in, that Florida is not going to be going blue much of any time soon. And mm-hmm. if we're looking at other greater national trends and some things that started becoming evident to us on Tuesday night, some of the shifts in different communities in Miami-Dade, specifically in the Latin American community, mm-hmm. Becoming less kind of block Democratic and beginning to favor some of the Republican candidates more. Mm-hmm. That's a big enough shift that it can move Florida pretty far.
Yeah.
Most of the states, you'll see that Democrats tend to do well in urban areas and in the denser city populations. Republicans tend to do well in the more rural areas. And one of the big questions is always, can the Democrats get enough votes out of the urban areas to counterbalance what the Republicans are getting out of the rural areas, where mm-hmm. there's, you know, maybe fewer votes in every county, but a lot more counties, right?
Yes.
So when you end up seeing a shift in one of the cities, specifically amongst the minority population, that can be the death knell for Democratic political futures in any particular state. I think that's what we're seeing in Florida. Yes. But I think maybe that's also why the red wave we started to see on Tuesday night in Florida didn't carry over everywhere else.
Yes.
Right? So, you know, by the end of the night on Tuesday night, we had a snapshot that it was not going to be a red wave. Mm-hmm. One of the first bellwether districts is one of the House of Representative districts in Virginia that was effectively carried by Trump, and in which we thought we were going to see the current Democratic incumbent booted. When she survived, that became a flag, right? That became, okay, maybe this is not breaking down the way we thought it was going to break down. Mm-hmm. And then to the reverse, we saw people like, I think it's Sean Patrick Flannery, who's actually the head of the Democratic Party's Congressional Campaign Committee, and who is elected from a House Representative seat in New York. Then we saw him in trouble.
Right. I remember.
Right. So, you know, one of the leaders in a, what Democrats would normally consider to be a relatively safe district in a safe state, suddenly he's potentially losing.
Okay.
And so I think Tuesday night, what we saw was the narrative kind of flopping back and forth. It wasn't what we thought it was going to be, but there were still pockets of that going on here and there. And, you know, if we needed, the last thing we needed in this election was more uncertainty. And that's what we seemed to get on Tuesday night.
Yes. Yes. So we had those, we didn't see the red wave. Think still the Republicans were thinking pretty hopeful Tuesday night. We wake up Wednesday morning and Arizona Senate's in play, Nevada's in play, Wisconsin, you know, surprisingly was still sort of iffy Wednesday morning. I think the Democrats woke up having a better morning than the Republicans Wednesday morning.
Yeah, because by Wednesday morning, we had what was the first true shock call. And it happened late Tuesday night, but we'll give it credit to Wednesday morning because that's when most people found out about it. And that was the victory of John Fetterman in the Pennsylvania Senate race over Mehmet Oz. That was a significant shift. And not only was it a significant shift in terms of some of the polls and projections, although Fetterman stayed ahead for most of the race.
Yes.
John Fetterman on the eve of the primary suffered a stroke. Right. And his recovery and his capacity to you know, be a senator was one of the things that was called in question. John Fetterman is also a very unconventional Senate candidate. Right. You know, this is a big guy wearing hoodies with tattoos on his arms, shaved head, you know. As a former bouncer, that's where I expect to see somebody like John Fetterman. And we'll see the exact same thing, right?
Yes.
So that's one of the things that many people have said, you know, is Pennsylvania a state which has its own kind of purpley tendencies?
Sure.
Is Pennsylvania ready to elect somebody like that over, you know, a very well known figure? In Mehmet Oz, who brings a lot of his own money and celebrity to the race, plus later on, you know, the endorsement of former President Trump, which carries a lot of weight in certain conservative circles. And at the end of the day, the answer was Fetterman won. And the reason that's so important to the overall balance of power and the reason why it changed a lot of the math through the rest of the country is that that Senate seat used to be Republican. It used to be held by Senator Pat Toomey, who retired. It was an open seat. But that was a Democratic pickup. That's a plus one for the blue side, which meant that the three currently still kind of outstanding Senate races in Georgia, in Arizona, and in Nevada suddenly became all must wins for the Republicans. Basically, they need to get all of them, or at least two of the three, to have a shot at a majority. And so we now, by realistically, I mean, we didn't find out until later into the day on Wednesday, but the math was pretty clear that Georgia was going to go to a runoff. Which meant that in order to make the runoff not the thing that counts, Republicans were going to have to win both Arizona and Nevada. And now, by the middle of the day on Wednesday, we were able to start getting some of more of the blocks of votes in out of Arizona and out of Nevada. And it looked like we were going to split the two of them. It looked like we were going to see a Democratic potential win in Arizona and a Republican win in Nevada.
Mm-hmm.
But that was as of the middle of the day on Wednesday. And by Thursday, the numbers had shifted some. Mm-hmm. In that when we as political scientists and mm-hmm. as people who are kind of making these calls for media agencies and trying to figure out who they can project as the winner, we're looking at the vote. There's lots of different factors that we look at to figure out what vote is still out there. And that's really the question, right? You guys can see a number 85% mm-hmm. reporting.
Yes.
Well, if the 85% of the vote is all of the vote from the rural areas and what's coming mm-hmm. in is city vote, that city vote's probably mm-hmm. going to lean more towards the Democratic candidate, right?
Yes. Yes.
And if it's flipped the other way around, if what's missing is the 15% from rural counties, then that could put the Republican over the line. Mm-hmm. Now we see even differences between same-day vote and mail-in vote and early vote, right?
Yes.
So that's one of the reasons why these now take so long to call, mm-hmm. is that they're so differently distributed as to who votes when, that when we're looking at a race like Arizona, it's largely urban mail and early vote that still have to be counted, which makes us pretty confident in saying it looks like Arizona is going to go for the Democratic candidates.
Mm-hmm.
In Nevada, it's more of an even spread, but mm-hmm. what's been coming in is not only mail vote, but Nevada allows for mailed ballots to be posted on Election Day.
Okay.
As long as they arrive at the Secretary of State's office within 4 days of the election.
Okay.
Which means that there are still potentially mail ballots that are moving to the election office in Nevada that they can't possibly counter project yet. Mm-hmm. So we'll know a better result on Saturday. I did the math on Nevada. Okay. And last I looked, it's a 9,000 vote difference.
Okay.
Between the two Senate candidates in Nevada. Now, in order, and there's about 130,000 votes still outstanding in Nevada.
Okay.
For Nevada to flip, right? For the Democratic candidate mm-hmm. to catch the Republican candidate in Nevada, they're going to have to win 54% of that remaining 130,000.
Okay.
If they do that, then they would get about 10,000-11,000 votes more, and they would climb up over the mm-hmm. Republicans' vote total.
Okay.
Now, the ballots that are coming in and the mail ballots we're seeing are coming back at a rate of about 63% for the Democrat.
Okay.
So they're actually, if that holds through the remainder of this 130,000 outstanding votes, the Democratic candidate will pass, at least the one for Senate will pass
mm-hmm.
the Republican candidate in that Nevada Senate race, which is why no one's calling that race yet.
Right.
Because we don't know about that.
That razor thin margin.
And really, that kind of takes us to where we are today. I moved through Thursday.
That's fine.
But that's nail biting kind of close right now.
Sure.
Crazy
thought when I was driving around the other day. Suppose, let's just say for fun,
mm-hmm.
The Democrats get in the Senate, Arizona and Nevada.
Yep.
Any thought that might work negatively toward Georgia in the runoff? That some folks might just, let's go red. They got mm-hmm. enough blue.
I think that's possible. Mm-hmm. I think what you would see, I don't know if it would change many voters who are already voting in Georgia. What I would think it would change is it would change the amount of national support pouring in behind Raphael Warnock.
Yes.
Right?
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And there already has been a bunch.
Oh, yeah.
Because people
yeah.
still think that the election may hinge on that special runoff coming up here on the 6th of December. But there will be a turnout lag. And we saw this in both of the runoffs that happened back in 2020, where the turnout for the special election will be down from the other election. Mind you, uh-huh. it'll be down even further likely because in 2020 it was a presidential year.
Yes.
So we had really high turnout, and we still had relatively high turnout for the runoff election. This is a midterm, so the turnout was already lower than the presidential year, and mm-hmm. we expect that we're going to see even lower turnout again when it comes yes. to the runoff.
Yes.
I think you're right in thinking that if that mm-hmm. does not if that is not the thing that causes Senate control to go one way or the other, mm-hmm. you could see people in Georgia who are less motivated to get out to the polls. Now, mind you, there are still people who split tickets, right? But I don't know to what extent there would be that many voters who are individually motivated who would have gone and voted for Raphael Warnock if Senate control was on the line. But if it's not, they'll go out and vote for Herschel Walker. Right? I don't know how large that swing electorate is. But I think you're absolutely right in noting that if that if the Democrats pick up Arizona, as it looks like they're going to, and then also pick up Nevada in that kind of a comeback scenario, that means that the race in Arizona is candy on the cake for them. And I think you'd see a lot fewer big national donors putting money behind Raphael Warnock, sending volunteers down to help canvas, things like that, which could end up hurting him.
I wanted to just check while you're talking. Right now, about just $35,000, 35,000 vote difference between Warnock and Walker. 80,000 people voted Libertarian.
And that's the difference right now. And that's those people will not, you know, obviously they will not have a Libertarian choice in the runoff. It'll be between Warnock and Walker. And that's going to be one of the big questions is, so those 80,000 people, are they just really strong Libertarian candidates who, you know, really believe in the Libertarian and don't want to vote either way otherwise? So if they stay home, the election could look a lot like this one did, minus their votes, at which point in time, you know, Raphael Warnock could win. If they are people who are more of a conservative disposition but didn't maybe like Herschel Walker, the question will be, one, do they show up? And if they didn't really like Herschel Walker, are they willing to kind of hold their nose and vote for him in the runoff? If so, then you could see some of those votes moving towards Herschel Walker, and that might put him over the top. There's a third scenario, of course, in which those people are, in fact, conservatively minded folks, but they look at Herschel Walker's inexperience, his record, some of the things he's said and done, and go, I don't want that guy. At which point in time, they could show up and be like, I would rather deal with a, you know, respectable, you know, pastor who's going to vote with me 40% of the time, as opposed to that guy who I think could be a real problem for not only what I believe in, but my party. So they could show up and back Raphael Warnock. So there are scenarios in which that Libertarian vote can help put Herschel Walker over the line and let him win the runoff. There's also several scenarios in which they either stay home or are, in fact, motivated because they don't want to vote for Herschel Walker.
And so, again, I'm watching all the news analysts last couple of days, you know, and I've heard more people tell President Trump, you know, he hurt the election, state elections in the last 3 days that I've heard in the last 6 years, you know, be anti-Trump or say something directly. And again, some of them, like Graham, will say that now, and he'll McConnell, and they'll switch later on. So I'm used to that.
So, yeah, there are big ramifications in the Republican Party as a result of this election. And I think if you look at some place, you know, Michigan in many ways is kind of leading the country in this, right? You know, pop for the home state real quick. In that, you know, Michigan went for President Trump by a small margin in 2016. He won this. He won this. This state. And we've seen in the past, you know, there are you know, statewide candidates for the Republican Party can do well. We had Governor Snyder not that long ago. And I think one of the things we're seeing is that there are people who have deeply and sincerely held conservative values, right? Who are not on board for the brand of politics and extremism that President Trump generally espouses, right? And I think there was a time in which in 2016 and maybe even later, many of them were willing to kind of, you know, look, he's not going to do everything that I want. I wish he would, you know, kind of shut his mouth and stop tweeting. But I think he's pulling in our direction. And so long as he, you know, lets us get the policies we need in or the Supreme Court justices that we think are going to be better for us, I'm willing to kind of go along with him. But starting in 2020 and here again in 2022, that brand of Trumpian politics is not playing well with the general election population. You can win a primary, right? You know, you can, you can get a lot of motivated conservatives out. You can win a primary. But the more moderate conservatives, the independents, they don't necessarily want somebody who is, you know, whose primary qualification for office is loyalty to Trump.
Yes. So, I mean, is it fair to say that much of this election was a referendum on President Trump?
I think it ends up being that. And that's really interesting because you would expect it to be a referendum on President Biden.
Yes.
Right? That would be the thing.
Right.
And so I'm going to go a step beyond that and say that, yes, part of it was a referendum on President Biden. Right. Mm-hmm. But the point is he did reasonably well. Right. Despite the, you know, his lower approval numbers. And one of the things with that presidential approval number that I want to bring up is that there always needs to be, if you're going to do that question responsibly, a follow-up.
Okay. Right?
Because do you approve of the job of the that the president is doing is one note. And so we're seeing, you know, let's say 44 to 56. So if there's 56% of the people who disapprove of the president's job performance, okay. The next question you need to ask in that scenario is, do you believe the president is governing, colon, too conservatively, not conservatively enough, you know, too liberally, not liberally enough, not, you know, so you need to figure out, of that 56%, where do they break down?
Yes.
Because if that 56% is all 56% of the people that are going, oh, he's a liberal nut job, then those people are probably going to be pretty united in voting against him and supporting conservative candidates.
Yes.
But if that 56 is split, right, and so you've got like 28% who are over here going, yeah, we think he's too liberal, but then there's another 28 who are going, actually, I don't think he's liberal enough. I wanted more progressive candidates. Where's Bernie Sanders, right?
Right.
That's the split. Then really what you have is you have people who are not going to be, you know, happy with Biden, but they're going to vote for Democratic candidates.
Yes.
In opposition to conservative.
And that's and you said it to say that's a lot of what we're seeing with Biden is a lot of the there's a lot of Democrats to the left of him that are saying he's not progressive enough.
Right.
And that negative approval number. And again, he's being pushed in both directions. Yeah. I'll have a question here. From Sabrina Smith, how much do you think the January 6th committee hearings impacted the Republican vote?
I think that they impacted the Democratic vote in new ways. I think that there were people who came out because this was in many ways kind of a referendum on democracy. And if it still is possible, we end up seeing either a very narrow majority for the Republicans in the House, or even if the Democrats are still able to hold it, which is still very possible at this point, then what that's going to be is that's the referendum on democracy, right? That's the referendum on whether or not you want something like the January 6th committee to continue holding potential negative actors from that event accountable, or if you're okay with the idea that there will be a lot of pressure from the far right on a Republican Speaker of the House to open up all sorts of investigations and impeachment proceedings against Democratic candidates and Democratic elected officials, even though those aren't warranted by the facts. I do think that there were probably some people who were stalwart Republicans who maybe had only gotten some of their news about January 6th through very biased media sources, who thought it's my duty as a citizen to check out these proceedings, watched them, and then went, oh, this is different than I thought it was.
That's a good, you know, see, now I was going to say, I thought it impacted the Republicans more because it keeps working its way, kind of how Watergate kept working its way further and further up. You kept saying, okay, there's this wasn't just an isolated incident and there's more and more people involved. But until you said the last thing, which was how many people really have informed themselves on how far this thing has gone up. You know, we got, you know, we're up to the chief of staff. We're up to a couple of Senate, you know, a couple of Congress people. And so if you're not listening to news sources that are really following it, I'm sure you aren't listening to a hearing that you probably haven't, you know, again, you just dismiss it as more of those, that gobbledygook from the people on the left.
Right. I mean, and that's, it's huge. I mean, the fact, the January 6th testimony had Republican members of the Trump administration verifying and validating the fact that President Trump knew that there were armed members in that crowd, knew that the violence was going on, knew that there were assaults going on against law enforcement, and very importantly, knew that he had the power to either de-escalate it by speaking directly to the crowd themselves, or defend the Capitol by deploying troops, right? He's the commander-in-chief. And that in the position to do either of those things to stop this from proceeding, he instead tweeted incendiary things about Mike Pence, further riling the crowd up. And if there's any one moment to my mind that that locks in his culpability for that incident, it's that, right? And so these are pretty well established facts at this point. And there are still lots of Americans who are working off the premise that, oh, it was either a fake news kind of event, a false flag kind of event, or that the people who were actually doing all the violence were somehow planted there by Antifa or something like that. And as we see more and more of these individuals involved in January 6th getting multi-year prison sentences as a result of it. And now that we're past the election, if we start to see some indictments of these larger figures and some of the political figures who were involved in it, I think we're going to see that become even a bigger factor maybe in 2024 than it was in 2022.
I'm a little older than you, David, so I can remember, you know, 10, 11, 12 years old following the Watergate hearings. And, you know, let's set a Clinton to the size. I think, to be fair, we kind of assumed Clinton had done what they said he did. It was a matter of how well he was going to defend it. But for me, I was like, okay, I believe he did it, you know. But remembering the Watergate hearings, you know, 10, 11, 12 years old, and every couple of days, again, it kept working up, you know. It was more and more people and more people involved. And then, you know, you had the big resignations, you know, and it just kept getting bigger. And to me, if everybody were paying attention to the January 6th committee, it's the same thing. Again, you know, you find out these records from, you know, this person's email, then this person's, you know, text messages, and these memos went across. And again, this, I mean, I don't know if people recognize the chief of staff is number three after the president, vice president. You don't really get any higher than that. And if he's the words, he's involved, you know, you're pretty hard to believe the president inculpable as well.
Yeah, well, especially because the vice president's largely outside the loop at this point, right?
Yeah, really. Yeah, I mean, we're just ceremonially, he's vice president's number two, but really, it's president, chief of staff, you know, for all practical purposes.
Yeah, especially if you're talking about hierarchy within the administration, who's calling the shots, the chief of staff is the guy who kind of controls access to the president, sets the president's agenda and schedule within the, you know, the structure of things. If there's anybody who you want to know to, in order to get access to the president, it is the chief of staff. So yeah, no, there's no question here. And I want to, I guess I want to also comment on the idea that this is big enough. And I think that the January 6th committee hearings were successful enough that we will be at a pretty strong point of crisis if we don't see further action in the coming weeks and months, right? Because what that will paint to the American picture is that despite the fact that we have now laid all of this very clear evidence out for you, there will not be accountability. Therefore, people are potentially above the law. And that's going to be a big problem for democracy as well. We've dodged some of the immediate problems for democracy, especially if there's a weak enough majority that we can't see a whole bunch of sham investigations and impeachment hearings.
We saw very intentional conciliatory speeches by candidates that lost. Very intentional. They wanted to get on record, you know, their concession speeches. In fact, I can't remember so many that made a point of making sure that their concession speech. No, some just generally just, you know, not paying attention. But you saw that particular those candidates, I think, who want to have a political future, making a point of, you know, acknowledging they had lost the election and, you know, and a fair election and looking to move forward. But I agree with you. Something, you know, we can't go through all this testimony on January 6th. And the worst thing would happen is would be as soon as the new Congress is set that, okay, we're done with that. Despite all the things that we know. And I, again, I'm assuming that this Congress is going to do something, take some more, you know, immediate actions between now and before they're they're disbanded in January.
I am heartened by the fact that, you know, even if the partisan affiliation of the House or both the Senate could still flip, but even if that happens, the Justice Department doesn't flip.
Correct.
Right? Yes. And that we are currently working with what appears to be a slate of competent, nonpartisan, mm-hmm. Justice-based officials in that department who, you know, have been doing dutiful investigations across the board and should be moving forward, right?
Yes.
And it's noteworthy that it's not just January 6th. If anything, the strongest Justice Department case against President Trump and some of the people in his orbit is really going to be the documents case right now. That one's pretty open and shut at this point.
Again, whether you see it as, I just took a few, took a few pages from work, mm-hmm. or you understand, top secret classified documents, right. Shabbily stored. You got, people, everybody handle them. You've had foreign representatives down at Mar-a-Lago. It's not White House. No, it's not an annex to the White House. It's a private residence.
Right. Yeah. And all presidential records are the property of the American people, period, end stop. Right.
Mm-hmm.
And if he wanted to set something up for his museum, he still never takes those records into his own personal possession. They
Correct.
Stay in the possession of the National Archives. The yes. National Archives then manages them and establishes them whenever he builds his presidential museum
yes.
or his presidential library, which is mm-hmm. fine, right?
Yes.
That's what every past president of both parties has done.
Yes.
But not only to take documents, but to leave them potentially unsecured, to lie about having them, to only return some of them when asked, right? And then to, upon the legal search of your premises, recovering hundreds of these crucial documents, lie again and accuse the FBI of planting them, and then mm-hmm. come up with a story that you psychically declassified them all before they left, is absolutely a horrific set of behavior, and for one for which he is deeply criminally liable.
Yeah. Would you think this is a fair statement? I would say for some presidents, Obama, Bush, Carter, they understood that when you're president, you belong to the people in the office. Mm-hmm. I would say Clinton probably got it late second term, mm-hmm. Maybe even after office, that, this wasn't my presidency. It belongs to the people and I'm serving. Yes. And the 45th president saw it as his presidency. One person said, I giving him the benefit of the doubt, I think his mindset is, I can take what I want to take.
Right. And I think that may be some level of his mindset, that he can take what he wants to take, and he's yeah. entitled to all of these things.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing is, that doesn't mean that if you do that, you are not culpable to the law, right?
Yeah, exactly.
If I think that I am entitled to walk into a jewelry store and take whatever I want, I will still go to jail. Right. Even
yes.
though I think I should be able to do that. Well,
yes,
that's a problem with me, not with
yes.
the law.
We gotta change the law to fit you. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. No.
Yeah.
So that's
OK. A couple of comments here, David, from Benita Threadgill says, agreed. Along the same lines, I believe the kidnapping plot against our governor also resulted in many making sure their voices were reflected in support of her and against the threats to our democracy. And again, Benita, I think we'd both agree with you. There are people, I think, on both sides that were kind of appalled at that, even shocked when the first trial ended without any, with the main people having to be retried again. But
right.
I would venture to say most Michiganders were appalled by that, even some of the most extreme. They may talk the rhetoric, but I even think some of the most entrenched extreme wouldn't want to see that.
Yeah,
I want to believe that. They may talk like that, but I want to believe better of most of the people to go out to vote. And I think to a degree that definitely affects. Certainly, I think for people who supported the governor, that interested mm-hmm. even further, that she withstood that. And that's an assault on your family.
Yeah, no, and I think I'll just follow up with that real quick. I think there's always going to be disagreements about how we can do things, right? Like, I can want prosperity and safety and success for the country, and somebody else standing next to me can want mm-hmm. those same things. And I think we should do it by, increasing taxes on the rich and creating a better social safety net. They think we should do it by cutting taxes and, reducing the size of government. But we both want the same thing, right?
Yes.
We both want that end thing. And if they win and they put in their policies and they work and we get there, then I'm going to be happy, right? Because we got to where I wanted to go.
Mm-hmm.
And if my policies do the same, hopefully they're going to be happy. But what we've seen in the last few years, and does have some historical precedent previously, are people who have been convinced that if the other side somehow wins, it is an existential threat, right?
Yes.
It's not that, you know, the people on the left are interested in you know, changing up the tax code or something like that. It's that they are actually all pedophiles who are trying to destroy America and, you know, all these other kind of entirely nonsensical conspiracies.
It's a whole TV network built on that premise, I believe.
More than one, unfortunately. Yeah. But I think that's the type of thing that motivates somebody who maybe used to be reasonably sensible to think,
yes,
oh my God, I have to kidnap the governor to stop her, right?
Yes.
And it's that kind of extremism, that kind of complete detachment from objective reality that is not only such a big threat, but I think has been one of the reasons that Benita is pointing out that people came together and went, whoa, 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 this isn't just politics anymore. You yes. guys have completely left reason.
Yeah.
And we need to make sure that you also don't get power while you're out there outside mm-hmm. of the realm of reason.
Yeah. Yeah. Sabrina Smith said, thank you for your answers, gentlemen. Michael Anthony Smith says, at the very least, the DOJ must act on the documents. And I do believe, again, if we're guessing, they're going to get some information handed over to them prior to this Congress being dismissed, and you know, Merrick Garland has an undefeated record. I thought that was interesting as a prosecutor. Mm-hmm. Okay, David, we got a little bit of time left. Let's 2024 started election when the polls closed Tuesday. What have we learned and not learned? Let's talk about the parties and how are they positioning, candidates positioning for 2024?
So let's start with the Republican side. Former President Trump has teased a big election on November, or big announcement on November 15th.
Do we have any idea what it might be?
Yeah. Who knows? Maybe he's launching a new line of, I don't know.
As I say, if you say you have a big announcement on the 15th, 2 weeks ago, you kind of made your announcement already.
Correct. Yeah. People expect that he's going to launch his 2024 campaign for the presidency. Part of that, by the way, also is motivated by an attempt to get in the race first in an attempt to scare off the person who is his most likely competitor in the form of DeSantis, who people have known for a while has been nursing a presidential run. And this could be a big kind of identity-defining moment for the Republican Party. If both of them are in the race and they challenge each other for the primary, that's going to be one of the nastiest primaries in the history of American politics.
Yes.
It's already starting to get nasty.
Yes.
And two, it will be, in many ways, the biggest come-to-Jesus moment for the Republican Party since the Civil Rights era. In that you've got an aggressive, in many ways, Trumpian-style conservative in Ron DeSantis, who is not Trump, right? And then you've got Trump himself and all of the political energy and elements that he's brought to the table in the last, you know, 5, 6, 7 years. So that's going to be the fight. I would go so far as to say there's no one else even on the map at this point.
If you're advising Mike Pence, do you tell him, look for a governorship, too much, too little, too late?
I don't even honestly know if Mike Pence would want to wade into that, though it's the potential that if he did, you could see both Trump and DeSantis damage each other and kind of split that much more MAGA Republican vote between the two of them, leaving a path for Mike Pence to win some key primaries. That's a possibility. But Mike Pence has never been particularly deeply charismatic, right? He's not somebody who's going to be able to really distinguish himself if those two are the ones, you know, engaging in the crossfire. So it's not impossible. But I also think there'd be a lot of strategic voting where people would be like, yeah, we think DeSantis can carry this. We need to beat Trump first. Republicans could be backing up behind one of the two. And it's hard to say. That's going to be pretty strong chaos.
Okay.
The other side is also pretty interesting.
Yeah.
Because we have President Biden, who is currently enjoying a little bit of a renaissance, but is also increasingly old. I mean, that's really the thing. If President Biden were 25 years younger, there'd be no reason to have this conversation, right? But he's not. He's, you know, like all of us, getting older every day. So sure. The first question would be, is he even going to seek a term? And he's actually given some pretty pithy answers to that recently, as opposed to, you know, people thought he might demur. There was at one point in time a theory that one of the things he could do is get past the midterms in this lame duck period, drop a whole bunch of relatively controversial executive orders, and then on January 2nd next year, resign, effectively handing a two-year term to Kamala Harris and allowing her to run potentially for 2 years in two terms after him.
Now, right? Having spent a lot of my life around politicians, they don't do that.
No, they don't.
They don't. Maybe 6 months, 3 months left. They don't give up half a term.
Right. Yeah. No. Yeah. That was one theory that had been kicked around, the idea that you'd have a Harris presidency at that point in time. She'd be coming in with 2 years of executive experience and, you know, be able to be the face of the party. I don't know that we would see if Biden chooses to run. I don't know that anyone will step up and try to stop him. Right.
Yep.
It's very difficult to challenge a seated president. And the question would be, who would do it?
Mm-hmm.
Right. Who would come after him? Mm-hmm. Vice President Harris is not going to, realistically. No. Bernie Sanders is not going to, realistically. I don't see Liz Warren stepping up to do it. And there's a bunch of, you know, like Pete Buttigieg or Cory Booker or other, you know, comparatively well-established Democratic politicians, none of whom really have a national presence the way that the other big ticket ones do.
Right.
But the idea that they're going to go after the president, I don't see it happening.
Yeah.
So the question is, does Biden want it?
Yeah. Kamala Harris doesn't seem, you know, I hear the stories that her and Biden don't get along. We kicked it around a little bit the other night. What is her deal? Is she does seem to be? I mean, vice presidents really don't do great stuff, you know. Biden, I mean, Obama patted Biden on the back as much as any president's patted a vice president on the back in years, and you know, Biden should probably kick himself for not running when Hillary ran. Mm-hmm. But is her stock way down? Is it possible it will go back up?
I don't think her stock is really necessarily down much at all. I think she has done what she needed to do in this intermediate period. Let the president take the heat, right? That's his job. If I were grooming her for a 2024 run, I absolutely want her a step back into the side.
Okay.
I take the heat for all the bad stuff. And what she's doing is she's getting used to all of the different kind of operations and levers of government. She's shadowing me in the presidency. And then over the course of the next 2 years, I'd probably make sure that she gets out front a lot more now that if there is going to be another election, it's going to be hers to run.
Yeah. Right? David, we are up against the clock. Hey, thank you so much for joining us, brother. I appreciate it. We're going to take a little break. Maybe we'll talk to you in December when we see what happens to this runoff. Thank you so much for joining us. Mm-hmm. All right. Folks, this has been Torn in Two. I hope that you've enjoyed the show. As my brother Greg would always say, go out, sow a seed, do something good for somebody. Take care.